The Survival Guide to Life, a podcast about how to win in life every second, physically, mentally, spiritually, financially, consistently.
Create sort of a video time capsule, so to say. So,
I love it.
I just noticed, you know, recently you just got your book published, and if you could sort of tell us what sparked it and what was the path leading to it.
Sure. So my book is called Life Launch, A Roadmap to an Extraordinary Adulthood. And what it's about is it's everything that I wish that someone had told me when I was in my 20s, and all the wisdom I've acquired from my own life and my clients' lives, like all packaged in one place to kind of launch you into creating the dream life that you want to have. And what inspired me to do it is I was working in my office for the last 15 years-ish, just one-on-one with clients. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be amazing to take what I've learned here and be able to pass it on to people that don't have I only have so many hours in the day, and not everybody can afford therapy. So wouldn't it be great for people just to have something super affordable that could set them on the path to figuring out how to live an emotionally fulfilling and physically fulfilling and money fulfilling life? So that's what it's about, and that's what inspired me to do it.
That's really awesome, because that's like even the title of the show, you know, Survival Guide to Life. I was hoping, you know, just to make like a guide for everyone to, like, you know, there's been times, I'm sure, like you, where you're like, man, I really wish I had like something that could just get me through this moment, you know? And I noticed, like, when I was just reading a little more about you and like how you had to face, you know, certain deaths with, like, you know, close families and going through that. And when I was in, I believe, third grade, my best friend, you know, the first friend I ever met, we were in karate class together. And one day I got a call to come home from, you know, Sunday school, like, and then I come home and my mom's like, oh, your friend Matthew died. I'm like, what happened? His parents had left him home alone. I don't know why at that age, but, you know, just for 15 minutes, but he was very hyper. So he tied the karate belt to the bunk bed and was trying to do flips and entangled himself. And then, so then after that, I kind of didn't really know what death was, or like kind of confused with life. And, you know, being like first generation into America, it's like, it's different trying, you don't really have anyone to talk to, because your parents' views are, or they don't understand what's going on now. So you kind of felt alone. And when you're, you know, depressed and things like that, and that, or you don't really understand anything, and you're trying to like develop a more growth set mentality, what was your changing point, and what gave you the ability to be like, oh, okay, my thoughts are my own, and I can choose the way how I can feel, and I don't have to feel like this. I can feel another way.
Good question. I mean, first I want to say, what an intense thing to go through in third grade. That's a lot of kids' first experience with death is their pets, which is still really intense. But to have it be your best friend, and it to be so sudden, like, that's a lot to deal with. So to your question about so what you're pointing to is that we can control our emotional destiny. And this is kind of a modern idea. People in past generations just kind of thought emotions just happen and you just deal with them and you move forward, whatever they are. And now, for the first time in the last 10 to 20 years, we're thinking about, how do I live a happy, peaceful, fulfilling existence? But the But the problem is we're new at it because we didn't even realize that we had control over what we emotionally experience. So for me, how I got there was you kind of mentioned, I went through a suicide of a cousin that was really, really close to me when I was 14 years old. And from there, I was so incredibly sad. And not only was I sad about his death, but every emotion that I had kind of stuffed down before that, I had tried to be this really perfect kid and never quite felt good enough. So every emotion that I had stuffed down surfaced when he died. And it took me to a place where I didn't even want to live. So sometimes when you're in the darkest of places in the most intense emotional experiences, that's where the change happens. Because it was like I had to figure it out. I had to figure out how to control my emotional destiny. Otherwise, I wasn't going to want to keep living. And so how as I had that awareness that I actually could feel something different, I went to therapy and I learned that the first way to control your emotional experience is to accept what you're feeling. So when we're sad, we have this tendency to go, I don't want to be sad. This is wrong to be sad. I want to be happy. But instead, it's almost you have to go to yourself. It's okay that I'm sad. It makes sense that I'm sad, as if you're comforting a little kid. Like if you look at a 5-year-old crying, you don't go, what are you crying about? Well, hopefully you don't. You go like, it's okay that you're sad. Yeah, you got hurt. That's hard. And the more empathetic we are and accepting of the feelings that we're feeling, the more they're actually programmed to move through us. So we go, it's okay that I'm sad. You feel the sadness and it will release, because they're not meant to stick around forever. They're just meant to signal us something for that time. So that's the first step, is accepting feelings. The second step is then going, how can I look at the world in a way that's going to evoke less scary, sad, painful feelings? So how, instead of like eventually with my cousin's death, instead of looking at it like life's never going to be the same and I'm never going to get to talk to him, I started to become grateful for the experiences I did have with him. And I started to be grateful for the fact that his death actually prompted me on my whole life path to have this career that where I now get to prevent other people from committing suicide. So that's the second part.
So with what you said from part one, and you know, just having this acceptance and, you know, like trying to talk to yourself as it was a small child, I noticed it comes with time and it comes with repetition. But even when you're able to do it and you're sort of, you know, getting it, it's like, you know, when you first start riding a bike and you have the training wheels, but then there are also times where you'll get it and you're telling yourself, but then right when you're telling yourself, it's like this constant battle, like it's like a tug of war, the way I say it, like where like a little self-doubt comes and then, no, I got this. And then what are like some tips or like some tools that you can to like win this like game of tug of war and like pull away from this self-doubt?
I love your question, and it's such a good description. So the first thing is to know, why does that tug of war exist? And why it exists is because, I'll let you in on a little secret, our minds aren't actually designed to be happy. So we think, like, why are we always thinking negatively? Why is it hard for us to accept our feelings? Because that wasn't the goal of our the goal of our mind is to survive. And so it comes from a time when we were living in the jungle, and the important part was that we didn't get eaten by a tiger, we didn't get kicked out of our tribe, we didn't starve to death. And so what is the best emotional state to make sure you're not going to die? It's being hypervigilant, a little bit anxious, and assessing danger at all times. So it's looking for what's wrong, basically. So now, most of us, hopefully listening to this podcast, are not living in survival. We're not facing life and death on a daily basis, and we want to be focused on happiness, but our mind hasn't caught up. So by knowing the fact that you're going to be swimming upstream in order to create a positive mindset, it kind of helps take the pressure off, because part of that tug of war, it says to you things like, you can't do this. That's stupid. Like, that's stupid that you're sad about that. Like, it starts to talk to you negatively, even about the emotional experience, because it's still trying to take you to the hypervigilant, anxious state looking at what's wrong. So the first thing I do when I could feel the tug of war is I say to myself, like, Jesse, like, thank you, mind, for trying to protect me, but I'm good. Like, I'm good. I'm just gonna be sad right now, and I'm gonna accept it, and it'll pass, and everything is okay. Awareness is a huge part of that. And then the second part is I rotate when feeling tough emotional experiences from accepting the feeling to distracting and taking a break, just to show myself that I don't, that I have the power. When I was going through my cousin's death, I would rotate from crying and journaling about it to watching cheesy reality TV to distract myself. So it's just figuring out, asking yourself, like, what do I need right now to feel more taken care of?
Okay, so like kind of like that self-love and like understanding your emotions and where your head's at.
Yes,
Okay.
exactly. And
So
then, like, another thing is, oh no, go ahead.
no,
Say,
please.
okay, another thing is meditation. Like, the reason, what is meditation really? It's the practice of separating from our survival instinct mind. It's sitting, because we're like, a lot of people will go, I can't meditate. I'm so anxious just to even sit still for a minute and listen to what it has to say. But what we resist will persist. So the more that we're afraid to sit with it, it gives it power to get stronger and to kind of take control and lead the ship, versus, no, I can sit with you, I can hear what you're saying, and negative mind, I can hear it, and I could not take it on. I could just hear it as a survival instinct instead of the truth. I have a sign in my office that says, don't believe everything you think. Because your mind's goal, it's just looking around for something to put you in that emotional state. What it says often isn't valuable in modern times.
And it's crazy to think how long it took us as humanity to come up with this realization. And I always say this, but like even though we've evolved so much from like those times where you said we needed to be in survival mode, where we're like watching out for tigers or just trying to get food, we had the hunters and gatherers. Now we're in like this new age where we're sending things out of space, digging tunnels to travel and flying in the air. But I feel like we kind of devolved as like human beings, as in like it says like teach a man to give a man a fish, feed him for a day, teach a man to fish, feed him for life. The man wouldn't want to learn how to fish, he'd rather use his phone and then order some food. And then I feel like all this technology, it like radiates so much EMF, and there's so much going against us that like it's hard to like build that and break that barrier into meditation or like trying to get into that spiritual oneness with our. That spiritual oneness with ourselves. So.
Yeah, it's all going faster, right? So I feel like we have to create we have to be more conscious of creating that space. And in some ways, the gift of the pandemic is it slowed everything down again for people to really ask themselves, like, what do I want in my life? What am I feeling about my life? What do I want to create in the future?
Yeah. What did you do, or like, how do you set up your day or week, as in having that time to just like dewind and like break that separation between your mind and then go back into reality and like go about your day?
So, I mean, I'm very structured in that way. Like, I just came off of a 7-day meditation retreat I did on Zoom, so I turned off all technology for 7 days. That's in, I guess, 4+ times a year. I'm not always going to turn off technology, but I'm going to take a big break, so of some sort. I love to snowboard, so that's how I like when I'm out in nature and I'm on the mountain, like, I'm not thinking about anything but my next turn, and it puts me in a really, in that oneness place. So that's one thing, I take breaks. Yep. In my everyday life, I get up and I meditate every morning. I also exercise 4 to 5 days a week because I think moving the energy in our body really helps. I make sure that I eat foods that are going to make me feel good and centered and bring the best emotional state out of me there. And then I like to make sure I'm laughing a lot, I'm connecting to people a lot, and I'm just creating space. So my whole life, I love my job, but the reason I love it and the reason I think I'm good at it is in part because it's only half of my life. It's not all of it.
Okay. So I like how you went about and you said, you know, you start your day and you meditate and then you go to the gym and then start your day. I've noticed this with a lot of successful CEOs or success coaches, and like, you know, Brian Tracy, for example, they say, yes, this is, I guess, like the winning routine is to, you know, get up early, meditate, work out, and then start your day. And it's hard, I feel like, for a lot of people, because it goes against what's being portrayed as, oh, this is what you should do, this is what you should do. So it's like going against what media is like saying, or like what the norm is, you know, so to say, and trying to break that and like, you know, sort of come into this new age that is understanding themselves and, you know, being more awake and trying to, you know, just go about with our lives and just being a positive influence. Now my next question was, how did you decide to devote all your time just for this?
Just for success coaching
and, yeah,
therapy? Like, how did I decide? Okay. Well, I went through that suicide when I was 14, and I took a nosedive in terms of my emotional health, and my parents were obviously really concerned, and they sent me to therapy. And the first person I saw, although so well-intentioned, was not helpful and made me feel kind of crazy. And like my destiny was maybe to go down the same path that my cousin did. A lot of my cousins struggled with mental illness, like bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. So the more she looked at me like that, the more I felt that that was my destiny, and the worse I got. And so about 6 months later, I ended up in a psych hospital. And then I got put on lots of medication for bipolar disorder, but I didn't have bipolar disorder. So that made me feel really off. You could only imagine being on really potent medication that you don't need. I was kind of a shadow of my former self. And so my parents just got more and more scared, and I got lost more and more hope. And then I came out, and a few months later, someone said, try this woman. And she was kind of far away, but my parents were willing to do anything. So we drove out to see her one night, and the first thing that she did different was she had my parents and me in the first session, and she looked at me and she said, Jesse, what do you want to be different about your family? Like, what do you think it needs to make you feel better? And she was the first person. She was looking at me like we were all in this together, not just that I was some crazy person that needed to be fixed. And that empowered me in a different way. And so that began our journey of me telling my parents what I needed to feel better, and them being able to feel more help, like less helpless, because now they knew what to do. And she changed my life. And from working with her, my family got better. I got better. I got off all the medication, and I loved it. I not only loved feeling better, but I loved the process of therapy. And I would tell her, send me another book to read. Like, so I was reading all the books that you would read in grad school to become a therapist in high school, you know, how different people did family therapy and what this person's theory of happiness was. And so I ate it up. And by the time I graduated high school, I knew that's what I was going to do. And I went straight through college, straight through grad school. And I was opening my private practice by the time I was 26 years old. So
That's awesome. But you know, it's crazy that you said that, how you went and you went to see someone and then they labeled you as, you know, having bipolar disorder. I had a guest on a previous episode. Her name was Dr. Gamble. She just specialized in like holistic healing. She said that, you know, one time she went to the psychologist and they said that she was, you know, bipolar, and they wanted to, you know, prescribe her medication like lithium and whatnot. I went to therapist before, you know, because parents, same thing. So I know how you feel. And she was like, no, I don't think this is right. And, you know, she refused to take that. And then that's what sparked her holistic approach. I feel like I think it's the DSM, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that they're trying to label everything. And
yes,
just as something is not to the social norm, but what is norm, you know? So I feel like before anyone, especially parents, you know, to come, don't be so quick to trying to label something as a problem, because it's the easy way out. Rather, just try to understand and see where the child is coming from, and that will prevent, you know, future things from progressing. Because like, I had a cousin who, you know, he had like a drug problem, and then his family, they were worried. They went and had him see a therapist, and then they gave him medication for that. And then that actually just made it worse. And then like, he was on it for so long that now, like, you know, he went into psychosis and schizophrenia. And I feel like if they didn't give that medication, they would have been slowly able to come out of it. And have you ever had clients now who were parents, and you kind of like try to coach them in a way that you felt like when you were younger, if you had that, it would have benefited you?
1,000%, yes. So, I mean, you bring up such a good point about the DSM. I think people get confused about that book. Like, it was invented in order for insurance companies to know how to pay therapists and psychiatrists and psychologists. That's what it's for. It's not actually, so it's used as this tool to put people in categories, but people's problems aren't that simple, and it doesn't say why the problem comes. It's just a classification system. So I don't like relying on it at all. And the first, I've done a ton of family therapy in my own practice. Like the first group I really specialized with was teenagers and their parents, because I was really young. So what teenagers would pick my profile online, their parents would say, you got to go to therapy. Teenagers would pick my profile online because I was the youngest looking one. I looked like a baby, you know, I was 26 and I looked like 20. So they would pick me because I looked relatable. They would come into my office, they would open up, and then I was able to tell their parents, like, this is what they need, or this is what they're trying to communicate that they can't communicate, and vice versa. The parents would tell me, this is what we're trying to tell them, but they're not hearing it. So I became a bridge between both generations, and I still do that a lot. It's my, I love doing family therapy, because like that first therapist taught me, that if you get your whole family system working well, that can be so healing and transformative in a long-lasting way versus just fixing. I do individual therapy too, but like just fixing one person is different than getting to work with the whole system.
And then see, you know, I always say there's three parts to a story, right? That's their story, and then the other person's story, and then the real story.
Yes, that's what I learned, really. I learned that too, because there is a theory in graduate school for therapists. They teach you to be really careful about seeing members of the same family. So if you see the daughter, a lot of therapists won't see the mother, for example, because they're afraid if you see more than one person in the same family, then your client will feel like you don't have their back. But my mentor taught me differently. She said, no, you see all the members that you possibly can, because you have so much power. And I remember I had this client who came in. I'd worked with this teenager for like a long time, and she was so mature and so articulate, and she was getting in these screaming fights with her mother, and I just was like, could not figure out how this is happening. Like, this person is so level-headed. And one day her mother and her had gotten in a fight on the way to my office, and I was like, bring your mother in, let's try to see if we could work this out. So we did a session with the three of us, and she was a completely different person when she was with her mother than she was when she was with me alone. She was kind of angry and poking at her and sarcastic and rolling her eyes. And I was like, I would have never known that had I not seen multiple members of the same family. So in that moment, I could help her go, I see why you're getting in screaming fights with your mother, because you are not talking to her in a way that she could hear. And from that point on, we started family therapy, and their relationship became completely different. And I've had that experience. That's just one example. I've had that experience over and over and over again.
So what was it like from all these clients? I kind of want to go like into your book a little bit. I'm just curious, and then, you know, maybe people can get a little sneak peek also.
Yes.
Like, is it from all these case studies, all these clients, have you like developed, like, you know, the ideal life that everyone wants to live? Do you have it in a way that's, okay, this is a baby, young adult, teenager, adult, or do you have it in like just different aspects and different perspectives as you go along?
Like the book? How is the book organized? Yeah. Okay, so the book is for young adults, and it starts with your emotional health. So the first three chapters are, how do you deal with your anxiety? How do you deal with your depression? How do you deal with anger? Because those are the three most common mental health stuff that you kind of deal with, that everybody on some level deals with all three of those things in their lifetime. So it starts there, and then it moves into your, how do you take care of your spirit? So it talks about why our mind is designed to be negative, and how do we start a meditation practice, and what do we do in order to get to our best selves and to let our best selves shine through more often. And then we move into the more practical stuff, like your career, your relationship with money. And then the final part is how do we do our relationships? So how do we cope with the problems that happened with our parents growing up? There are no perfect parents. There is no perfect childhood. So there is going to be stuff that we're going to carry through from our original relationships with our parents or caregivers into our current relationships. And it explains like why that is and how to deal with that. And then from there, it goes, how do you find a romantic partner? How do you create a good relationship with a romantic partner? And how do you create good relationships with friends? And so that's kind of the trajectory of the book, a 360 degree view on what I think you need to have a good life.
And it's I always have this quote, you know, everything echoes, and like even I guess it goes even in your mind, because now in my head as you were speaking and I'm listening, I'm the back of my head's like, okay, next question. I was like, okay, I want to ask and more like, what is like the process or like, you know, a healthy way to make friends, one, and two, how can you meet a romantic person in the right emotional state? So you, before I could even ask, you said
well, that's great. So, okay, so we'll take one at a time. So with friends, like the big thing with friends is what I think is really healing about friendships is that they're the place where we just really learn to accept people for who they are. They're not our romantic partners, so they don't have to fill all of our needs. All we have to do is find where we both connect and appreciate that. And the stuff that annoys us or we don't like, maybe they're flaky, then if they're flaky, then we don't invite them to events that they have to be at on time or that we're going to be really disappointed. The friendships are our breeding ground for accept. And how do we meet them? I think we go out, it's a little tricky now in the pandemic, but we find things that we're interested in. School is a great place. If you're out of school, then you can find common interests. I loved Meetup for that. That's how I met friends. I was into surfing, and so I met a whole group of women who met on the weekends to go surfing together, and then we ended up going to Mexico. So things like that. I think it's just about putting yourself out there, and then once you're in the situation where you're meeting people, really asking people questions. People love to answer questions about themselves. They love to feel like you really want to get to know who they are. So go into it with the intention of really figuring out who these people are and really understanding what they're about. Because I think sometimes we're like, what do I say? You don't even have to say any, ask them questions. There's something that makes this person tick. You just got to figure out what it is.
So, you know, with building friends and, you know, trying to build relationships that, you know, are meaningful and, you know, trying to also know when you should, there's a time to be selfless and then there's a time where you should be like, okay, you know, I got to take care of myself. And like, how do you get away from being that person who's always saying yes, always saying yes, and then, you know, you're trying to help everyone, but you never help yourself? And someone said, you know, before you can like help someone else, you should make sure you're okay and then take care of someone else.
Well, I live by that, so I think put your own oxygen mask on first. That's true. Because you're not going to be the part where I'm saying to show up with acceptance and unconditional love. You're not able to do that if you're not giving it to you first. It's not even possible. So Yes. So I think what you're saying is, how do I draw boundaries? Like, what's giving too much?
Yes,
You know?
exactly.
Yeah. So how I kind of look at, what do I have to give? So I don't really have, it's going to be really, if you're my friend, you kind of know I do all my sessions Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. You're probably not going to get me on the phone. I'm not going to be a very present and helpful friend in the middle of the week because I'm taking care of my business. And so if you're my friend, then you're going to like understand that about me, and you're not going to be, and I'm not going to worry about taking care of you during that time. So that's one way. And then the other way, like, I'm figuring out like what feels good to me. Okay, like my dad, actually, he just is coming to stay with me for a little bit, moving in today. And tonight we're gonna have dinner with him and his wife and my husband's parents. And I was thinking, oh, you know, my friend Sarah, she would add a lot. So I'm going to invite her to come, and that will feel good. But if I started inviting five friends or five people, that would be too much. I wouldn't feel good. So I guess this is a long way of me saying, you keep checking in with what feels good to you. If it feels good, you give it. If something in your body goes like, I don't know, that doesn't feel right, or I don't have that to give, or I'm tired, then you don't.
And then that's when it just comes with time, when you got to stop going against your intuition. Like,
You'll develop it, because I think sometimes we're giving from fear. We're afraid if we don't do X, Y, and Z, or show up in this way, then that person's gonna leave or not love us. But the people who are really worth it to be your close friends won't feel, they will accept what you have to give. They'll be appreciative for what you have to give. And the people who are gonna be upset with you that you don't have something to give, they're just not gonna be your good, like, they're not gonna be good friends.
And then, yeah, that's when it comes with time, like, who are your real friends and who are your acquaintances.
That's right.
So then, transitioning and, trying to meet a romantic partner, say someone who's, come off this domino effect of, similar people over and over again. And then them trying to look for a person and trying to not fall into that same trap. And when I've talked to friends and they've told me, like, I always feel like I'm talking to someone, but then they turn out to be the same. Correct me if I'm wrong. What I said was, you need to first, whatever past traumas you have or whatever things that you haven't gotten over with or come to terms with, you have with your previous partner, whoever you meet, you're gonna just trajector those emotions that aren't even really there. You're gonna create them and push them towards them, and you still need to develop your self-love so you can. If you're not loving yourself and you're insecure about these things and trajectorying these emotions that aren't even real, you can't really love that person or see them for truly who they are.
You're doing my job for me here. So, but yes, I think when someone is going meeting, feeling like they're meeting the same pattern, they're the same person and creating the same pattern, normally what that signals to me is exactly what you said. There's something from your childhood, actually. I'm going to go further back than even your relationship. There's something from your childhood that you didn't work through. So our parents are our relationship to them, and their relationship to each other is our first test of, it's our first example of what romantic relationships should look like. And so there are going to be imperfections in that. And if we don't work that through and come to a place of great understanding about what those imperfections are and what we want to take with us and what we want to leave behind, not only intellectually but emotionally, then we can unconsciously be trying to work that issue through with our future romantic partner. And so I would say if your friend is attracting the same person, I would have them, one, read the last section of my book. But if they still can't figure it out from reading that section, I would hire a therapist. You don't have to go to them for years. Go to them for 6 sessions to help them figure out what they're recreating so that they can attract somebody different. Because sometimes that stuff's so unconscious that it's hard to figure it out on your own.
I agree. And I feel like that's where, like, everyone should sort of have, like, a mentor or something, someone that can, you know, guide them in all aspects, you know, physically, mentally, emotionally, and, like, sort of help them through, because the only way, you know, like, I feel like that's how, like, knowledge was ever passed down in just humanity, and, like, even before we have knowledge in books, but it's passed down from person to person. Like, it's always been, you know, that transition, like, from one person to another. And I feel like that's, like, how knowledge has been, like, truly kept. And, like, the best way to do that is to seek help, like you said. But then some people have this negative connotation about therapy and stuff. How do you get through to someone like that? Like, you know, like, say they're listening to this, and, like, they're, like, either shy or they feel intimidated, you know, what would you say to be, like, you know, it's okay, like, this is going to help you?
I would say a few things. One of the reasons I became certified as a coach, my therapist friends were like, why do you need to become a certified coach? Your degree as a therapist actually took a lot more. It's a higher degree, you know, it took more years, more hours, more study. So why do you need to do this other thing? And part of the reason I did it was because a lot of times people look at coaches with less stigma. They go, oh, the coaches here, people who are successful have coaches. Most of them do, because they know that spending time on a weekly basis, being introspective and thinking about your emotions and thinking about being conscious about how you want to be in the world creates positive effects in their lives. So I would say, let's just take the stigma off. Like, we go to the gym to get our body. We don't expect to be in great physical shape without working out. We don't expect to get smarter without going to school or reading. And so why would we expect to be awesome at dealing with our emotions without putting energy and effort into it? So I'm biased, obviously, but the people I know that go to therapy, they have a different kind of self-awareness to go into the world, and they have more control in being able to create the emotional space they want to live in if they pick a therapist that's good for them. So that's the other thing I want to say. If you go to therapy and you try someone and you're like, I don't know, this doesn't feel right, or I don't really feel understood, keep going. All therapists aren't the same. Like, try somebody else. And if you've never been to therapy, I recommend, most therapists will give you a free 30-minute introductory phone call. So set that up, ask for that from 3 different people, just so you can get a feel for how different people feel differently to you, and then go try them. And then whoever you pick from that, go try them for a couple sessions. And if you're not going there feeling like, I'm really going to get something out of this, switch until you find the person that you're in sync with and that can help you.
Okay. I like how you said that, you know, just you got it from me trying to, like, give you an example of someone who's thinking his therapy is wrong. Right away you said coaching, and then boom, I didn't even think of the therapy. I was like, oh yes, this is something that I should do and I need.
Awesome.
I heard you earlier, you're talking about, what you do to give yourself time or like kind of get away from the technology. You said you like snowboarding and you like surfing. I thought that was pretty cool. Living in Chicago, I just was able to skateboard, but just seeing a lot of surfing or how even skateboarding just started from surfing and just
Yes.
snowboarding, you must have a really strong core and like ability. What's that like? And like describe, like your emotions or just like how you feel just riding the wave.
So I do love, I still love being in the waves, but I do less surfing in the last 10 years than snowboarding just because of time and where I am, location to the beach. So I'll talk to snowboarding because that is just my thing. I feel like I'm floating on a cloud of bliss. That's how I feel. And during this COVID, during this pandemic, all the mountains got shut down. But what didn't get shut down is what's called backcountry touring. So I have this board, it's a snowboard, it splits in two, it turns into skis. And then you put something sticky on the bottom. It's called a skin. And you hike uphill into the mountains. So you could hike for two, three, and you can go as long as you want. I was doing from 2 to 4 to 6 hours, okay, on the weekends. And then you hike down and then you snowboard down a beautiful run, like completely by yourself with no one around. Because I'll say part of what I love about snowboarding is getting to go fast, getting to float like a powder day. There's nothing better than a powder day. And part of it is also the nature. I just think nature and space is really healing for our psyche. So that's just, if you ever saw me on the mountain, you just see me as my best self, laughing, full of joy, ready to like no. And then at the end of the day, my friends always get upset because they're like, "We're exhausted. We gotta go home." And I'm like, "One more, just one more. I think we could do it. It's gonna be great because I never want to leave
That's
once I'm
pretty.
out there."
Have you ever recorded any of your runs or anything just to like have that like I know I'm talking about getting away from technology, but just to be able to just like go back to that moment.
Yeah, my husband, like one of my birthday gifts, because he likes taking picture and video more than me. So for one of his birthday gifts, I got him a GoPro. So we put it like we have helmet mounts, and there's some great video footage of us in Japan, and we've gone all over the world. So we are the only people that find this video footage so fascinating because we're remembering the experience, but lots of people in our lives have been subjected to sitting through some hours
Oh,
of
okay. Just like all your friends are over, a family, like, oh, you come look at
look
our
at this.
scissors.
And then we went over here, but you can't, it's a storm. A lot of times we're snowboarding in a storm because that's when the powder's happening. So it's not as exciting to see as it is to remember and feel.
That's really cool. I was only able to, like here there's not really much mountains, so we have like little hill, like pretend mountains, hills. It was fun. I definitely want to try to go more and get the ability to do that. So I would say everyone should, whatever it may be, maybe playing sports or something like that, just give that time for yourself. And how do you when you feel like you're not completing anything and like you kind of sort of like wake up, you're like, oh, okay, I gotta get this done, I gotta get this done, I gotta get this done. Then when you look at the end of the day, you kind of like went from one thing to another and really didn't complete anything. Trying to just like focus all your power and energy to one thing, complete that at one thing at a time, and then once that's complete, go on to the next. Do you kind of like physically like make a schedule like, okay, I'm gonna do this at 8, do this at 10, or like, how would you go about doing that in a strategic way?
Good question. I think everyone's different and everyone has to figure out their system. So some people need a really strict system where it goes from 8 to 8:15, I'm doing this. And some people just need to know, today I'm going to accomplish this, or this week I'm going to accomplish this. Like, so I personally, I have a schedule that's pretty strict, and then I have what I'm going to, I have my goals for the month. Actually, I have my goals for the year, my goals for the month, my goals for the week, and my goals for the day. So it's broken down. So this year, for example, like I'm working on a TED Talk. So this week, I'm going to watch 2 hours of this presentation course to help me mold the content in a way that's going to be interesting. And then next week, I'll do the homework from those 2 hours, and so on and so forth. So my big thing over and over and over in my book, is baby steps. If you break things up into small enough steps, anything is accomplishable. It's when you look at something and it feels too big that we start to procrastinate. A lot of procrastination is fear. So we start to procrastinate and we start to avoid. So the thing is, break up everything that you want to accomplish into a small enough attainable step that when you sit down to do it, you're like, I can do that. Yeah, no problem. I got that. So that's one part. The other part is, it's really important that you do what you say you're going to do. So a lot of times people go, well, I want to get a lot done and I have this big goal and I'm going to do it all. But if over and over you're writing down things that you're not doing, what you're teaching yourself about yourself is that you're not a person that is true to their word. And so it becomes harder to motivate yourself because your sheets and your goal, they don't mean anything to you anymore. So I go, I would rather make my goals really small and not time consuming and get them done than I would make them big and get half of it done. So you start small, and then people are like, but I'm not going to get anywhere because I'm taking these micro steps, Jesse, and I'm never going to get to my goal. And I'm like, no. You have 4 weeks in a row where you've seen you've accomplished your micro goals, then we're going to expand them a little bit bigger. And it starts to create, and we're going to tell ourselves what a good job we did at being true to our word and accomplishing our goals so that we start to get in a positive momentum cycle. Because the more we accomplish and the more we tell ourselves we're doing a good job, then the more motivated we are the next day to wake up and do more. If we start telling ourselves, like, that wasn't that big of a deal that I, for example, meditated for a minute, I should be meditating for a half an hour every day. Well, then who wants to like try again? You know? So that's the thing, is that you start small, you're structured, and you know by the time I go to bed tonight, these are the three things that are going to be done, for example.
Okay, I like that. What I always try to say is, sort of like what you were iterating about, start your day, have your long term, short term, and then daily. And then after your day goes, check in and be like, okay, what did I do? And then
Yes.
what would I do differently if I could do this again? And then if just
Yes.
by doing that and keep doing that, then like, you become more strategic, and then you're able to achieve a lot more, I feel like.
Yeah, I think that's great advice.
And then also having like smart, like someone taught me the system is like SMART goals and like clear goals, as
Yes.
having them be like clear and like timed. So like if you don't like say like, oh okay, I'm trying to lose 50 pounds before I get married, for example, you know, to fit my suit.
Yes.
And I'm over here and eating a Big Mac 1 week before the wedding. You know what I mean? If you like have it timed, I think that that's also a big, big help. And just as you talk about your book more and more, I see the need for everyone to read it, and I find it pretty cool that you're gonna do that TED Talks, and I just wanted to know a little more about it and how that started.
I love TED Talks myself. I think it's a great way to take in information because it's like bite-sized pieces that's manageable. And when I watch a TED Talk of someone that inspires me, then I'm also inspired to dig deeper with their other stuff and read more. So I just thought this would be a really good way to put out there some basic ideas about how to get yourself and your mind in the place so that you can feel happy and at peace. And then if people wanted to know more, that would be a great segue into the book or reaching out to me. So I'm excited about taking this project on.
That's extremely cool. And, you know, all the luck to you. And like, you know, I hope that like kind of more sparks a way for more people to see what you're doing and appreciate it and then benefit from your insight and your expertise. Because just this little time, you know, just having this conversation with you, I've felt a dramatic like 360 already. And like after we get off the call, I'm gonna get the book and start reading myself, you know. And then I wanted to kind of talk about, you know, you also have your own podcast, and what sort of created that, and what is your strategy and your implementation on like episodes go?
Thank you, first of all. Like, I'm so glad that this conversation's already been impactful. Like, just made it worth it just to hear that. So that's great. And so the podcast, I love podcasts too. I listen to podcasts. It's another way I take in information a lot. And it was, I did the 8 episodes that I've done of my podcast so far, actually before I wrote the book. It was my way of, short. They're like 10 to 15 minutes long, and they're like little stories to teach you some of the concepts that we've been talking about today, like how to deal with, how to set boundaries around when you have a friend that's having a tough time, and how to take care of yourself in that, or why I quit drinking when I wasn't an alcoholic, or the recipe for a successful relationship. So they were kind of my testing ground to see if people responded to this well, because I didn't know if the knowledge that I give during sessions would translate to people who didn't know me without having a back and forth conversation. So I made those, and I got a positive feedback, and people wanted more. So that's, I leaped from that to writing the book.
Oh wow, that's a big leap. That's like going from the bunny hill, right, so to say, to the big and then if anyone was listening, if they want to know what that podcast is, it's Live Better with Jesse Gunte. I want to pronounce it
It's a tricky name, so my name is Jesse Junta Rafe.
Okay, Junta Rafe. Okay, see, I apologize. I wanted to pronounce it properly. I was like, okay, how is it?
So, no problem. No one, because it's spelled Giunta, and no one gets, because it's Italian, the G is like a J.
I figured it was Italian because of the I-U-N, but yeah. I still couldn't get, I felt like because I only spoke English, my whole life until I was like 20s, and then I took a year off to learn, read, write, and speak classical Arabic, and it was like from 7 in the morning till 7 at night, and just being in that, I felt like after I kind of like lot like sort of forgot my like speech or like grammar in a little bit. Because it was like so drilled in our mind, I think in that aspect all the time. So, coming towards all this, and you have your book and your show and your newsletter, where do you want to drive your legacy towards next?
It's all about, because the book's so new, it just got released in August. Like, to me, it's like all about the book. And for a while, it's going to be about that, seeing how I could get it out there and hopefully help some people will get some good things out of it. That's where I am right now. I'm just all about the book.
Okay. So do you have like a special team that will like help, with your promotion of your book, as in, promoting it di like through social media and aspects like that, like running targeted ads and things in that realm?
Yeah, so I hired some marketing people and we're just getting started, so we'll see what they're gonna do. I'm not sure.
Okay, yeah, no, just because that's it's one of my actually businesses and companies I do, and then I was just like that I just wanted to tell you, if you weren't doing it, you should. That's like a really good way in the times we're in now, like these Instagram ads and these even YouTube ads, and even with Facebook's ads, how cost efficient it is and just the outreach you can get, it's so beneficial. And I
I
think it's pretty
noticed,
cool.
thank you. I noticed that I ran an ad actually on Facebook, Instagram, so to give away a free chapter, which people are welcome, by the way, to go to my website, which is my name, jessiejuntarafe.com, and go to the book page. And if you put in your email, you get a free chapter of the book. And so I got positive feedback from doing that, and it's nice to be able to give something for free too.
Yeah, that's really cool. So I know everyone's gonna try to jump on that, and I guess that's where it kind of comes as a balance of this like technology kind of like bringing us down, but like then there's like a benefit with that, because especially with these times now, a lot of people are facing a lot of emotional struggle, because of financial situations or health situations, and people. And coaches like yourself going out and doing this and spending the time and being writing a book is not an easy thing. People just think like, oh, it's just a book, but it takes a lot of time, effort, emotional like health to just to go through it and to be able to do that. It's a really awesome thing, and I just want to commend you for it. And
Thank you.
now, just with one question, I want to like sort of wind up with and like end with is, anxiety is probably one of the biggest things you could say, especially now, that is prevalent. And
Yes.
I've had like a lot of, friends and, just have problems and, gone down a wrong path with like medication that's given for anxiety, like say Xanax, for example, and then how to target them or, not get them used to that. Especially I wanted to say with my aunt just recently, like I guess she's had, and like they said her family, it happened before a long time ago, she kind of went into this shock with this COVID-19, how everything's happening, and she can't, she won't speak, to anyone. Like she just doesn't talk, she just waves her head, eats very little, and her parents had to fly down and come from Sri Lanka and try to get her out of it. And then they had to prescribe her these medications, and I feel like I don't want people to have that as a crutch or a handicap against themselves.
I'm so sorry about your aunt. I'm not sure what you're asking.
No, it's like how like what's like a way for someone to deal with their anxiety and especially right there at the moment when they're getting a panic attack and not depend on a medication.
Okay. Well, the first chapter in the book is all about anxiety, so I think that would be like the place to really go to dive deep about this. But I think the thing to know about anxiety is it's fear of the fear. So it's placed not actually in the present moment, it's placed in the future somewhere. If we're in the, normally we are not actually facing the danger that we're freaking out about. So the first thing to do is to ground yourself. I tell my clients if they're starting to have a panic attack or get really anxious, to feel where they feel it in their body, and then to put their hands on it and to breathe into that place a color of calm and a color that represents calm and peace and presentness, and to breathe out the freak out, pick a color for that, and to just sit. And also being in the grass is good for that. And sometimes walking is good for that. So that's the immediate, like, I'm in a freak out, is how can you ground yourself in the present? In the long term, starting to know what we were talking about at the beginning of this podcast about the idea that the mind is designed to be negative and it's designed to make you a little hypervigilant and anxious. So knowing that will help you to start to, when your mind starts giving you all these thoughts that are making you anxious, to stop and to kind of either go, thank you, mind, like, but I'm good. I don't need to think about that's not happening right now, and I don't need to think about that right now. Or if you can't get them to stop, right, I'm a big fan of journaling. Write down everything that's making you anxious, and then take one thought at a time. Starting with, let's say, starting with nobody likes me, let's say. And then I want you to reality test that. So, but who does like me? Who can I feel love from? Is that really true? And then if there's no, well, and if there's nobody there on that, normally people have somebody, but if there's nobody, then you go, well, how can I make more friends? What steps can I take to make that different? Because all of us are likable and lovable when we're ourselves. And so it's just, how am I going to go about meeting those needs? So that's kind of the cliff notes of how to deal with anxiety.
Okay. I like that. I always just say, when you said, it's just fear, all fear is false evidence appearing real.
There you go.
Yeah. So just to think of that and remember that, and just one more time, if you can just drop or say your social handles, how anyone can, connect with you on LinkedIn, Instagram, or Facebook, and your website.
Thanks. So it would be going to jessie-junta-rafe.com, which I'm sure you'll put in the show notes because my name's tricky to spell. And then once you're at my website, it'll link you to all the Instagram, the face, it'll link you
Okay.
everywhere else.
All right, perfect. And then I always have the guests, end with a quote that, maybe recently you just came across or something from the past that came up again, but that's just kept popping up in your head and popping up in your head.
Okay, so one of my favorite quotes was from Viktor Frankl, and he was Jewish in the time of World War II, and he and his whole family were put in a concentration camp, and everyone was killed except for him. And what he said was, the last of human freedoms is to choose one's attitude in a given set of circumstances. So despite his whole family dying and all his freedom being taken away, he was not going to choose to let the Nazis take away his ability to create joy in his life. And he went on to write a famous book about that and to inspire other people. So I love that example, because people are like, how could I be feeling calm when X, Y, and Z is happening? And I'm like, well, how could Viktor Frankl feel good when, like, the worst case scenario is happening for him? If he could do it, we all can do it. So
there you go, guys. Jesse Giante Rafe, thank you very much, and I appreciate your time and all the knowledge you've dropped on us. And I'll be sure to be in touch, if that's okay. And
yes,
I'll be hoping to continue this relationship and benefit from your expertise. Thanks again, and have a nice day.
Thank you so much for having me.